Welcome to Talking Tax, a Bloomberg Tax podcast. In this series, we talk to attorneys, accountants, and other tax professionals about the latest developments in the world of tax. I'm your host, Andrea Ben-Yosef, and we're excited that you're here with us today. It may be surprising to know that the death of a person does not end the ability to plan for their estate, especially in minimizing the income and transfer taxes. Mark Beckerman is with me today to discuss, in a two-part series, how estate planners can still take actions after a person's death to maximize the benefit to the beneficiaries. Part one will cover estate tax and related questions, and part two will cover income tax questions. Mark Beckerman is a solo practitioner in Long Island, New York, who limits his practice to trusts and estates. Mark is also an adjunct professor of law at New York Law School, where he formerly served as the associate director of its graduate tax program, and is also a member of the Bloomberg Tax Estates, Gifts, and Trusts Advisory Board. So, Mark, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Andrea.
So we're going to get started with part one of the series, which is postmortem estate tax questions. So let me just ask you first, how important is postmortem estate tax planning?
Well, postmortem estate planning in general can be very important, especially if you have the right facts and circumstances. We're dividing the talk, as you mentioned, into estate tax for this session. Obviously, with the increased exemption amounts on the federal level, there's not as much federal estate tax planning that needs to be done prior to death, and correspondingly, not as much that needs to be done after death, because most people don't have any estate tax consequences with the current $11 million plus exemption. But I would caution, first of all, that there are still clients that do have that kind of estate for estate tax purposes. And second of all, some states, such as New York, have a similar law to the federal estate tax, but with a lower threshold. So in my practice in New York, I am still doing both pre-mortem and post-mortem estate tax planning for clients and their estates.
So you can do this for both state estate taxes and federal estate taxes?
Correct. So for example, New York has roughly a $5.5 million exemption. So if I have a client who has a $7 million estate, there's no federal estate tax consequences thanks to the over $11 million federal exemption. But the New York exemption being only about $5.5 million, we do have some New York estate tax consequences. And some of the planning that we do after death, which we'll talk about today, really is some of it is fairly straightforward if you understand it and can benefit the family in reducing even just the New York state estate taxes.
All right. So can you give an example where an estate may have significant estate tax savings due to postmortem planning?
Absolutely. Probably the most basic form of postmortem estate tax planning is making an alternate valuation election for estate tax purposes. So generally speaking, assets which were included in a decedent's estate for estate tax purposes are valued as of the time of his or her death. The Internal Revenue Code permits an election where there's an alternate valuation date, and that alternate valuation date will depend on what is done with the asset. So, for example, if the asset is held for 6 months or greater by the estate, the alternate valuation date is 6 months after the estate, after the estate was created after the date of death. If the asset is sold or distributed or transferred, the alternate valuation becomes the date of the sale or the distribution. So if, for example, you have a stock which is worth $1 million date of death, and the executor holds the stock and 6 months later that stock is worth only $900,000, the valuation for alternate valuation purposes would be $900,000, thereby reducing the estate tax. The gross estate for estate tax purposes by $100,000. But there's a couple of rules associated with the election. First of all, the election has to be made for all assets. So you don't get to cherry pick which assets have gone down and only elect alternate valuation for those assets. You'd have to elect alternate valuation for all assets on the estate tax return. Second of all, there's no change in the valuation of assets where the value changes due to the mere passage of time. So for example, if you have a bank account of $100,000 and the executor doesn't touch it, and 6 months later it's $102,000 due to interest only, then that would still be $100,000 for estate tax purposes. alternate value of cash is always the same as date of death value, which is kind of a corollary. And then the election must reduce the estate tax. So you cannot elect alternate valuation unless you're going to eliminate the estate tax. Now, most estates have no estate tax because of the exemption, so alternate valuation isn't even an issue. Further, if you have a married situation, there may be no estate tax due to the marital deduction available to the surviving spouse. If you have a typical formula type plan where there's no estate tax on the first spouse to die, there'd be no possibility for alternate valuation in order to reduce the tax past zero. And this becomes important because the backside of this, if you will, is that the beneficiary or the estate, if the estate sells an asset, takes a basis in the asset of the value used for estate tax purposes. Now, for most people, we call this the step up in basis, but these days with the stock market, it could be a step down in basis as well. Right. But you take a date of death value as the rule of thumb. However, if an alternate valuation election is made for estate tax purposes, instead of using the date of death value for the basis going forward, you use the alternate valuation which was used for the estate tax purposes. So you're saving some estate tax on the front end, but there's a likelihood that there will be some more capital gains tax down the road. You're kind of kicking the can down the road a little bit. But again, the estate tax rate is 40%. Long-term capital gain rate is less than that. So for many people, they're willing to make that trade-off. So that's a fairly simple, straightforward way that you can do a post-mortem plan, making an alternate valuation election on the estate tax return to reduce the estate taxes owed by the estate. And similarly, if there is generation skipping transfer tax that's being implicated, that would hold for that as well.
All right. So you mentioned that one downside was a possible increase in capital gain. Are there any other possible complications?
The other thing which I find in my practice is if you have hard-to-value assets like real estate or business interests, yes, you really do have to go and get a second valuation, which a lot of clients are a little hesitant to do because whatever the appraiser charged the first time, they'll probably charge a little less the second time to update the appraisal, but there are the fees and expenses associated with additional appraisals for tangible personal property, real property, business interests, things of that nature.
Okay, so let's get down to something, you know, more practical. Where should the administration expenses be deducted, the estate tax return or the fiduciary income tax return?
That's a great question, and the easy answer is we don't really know. Unfortunately, this is an area that very often you have to run the numbers because depending on the state you're in, you may only have federal implications, but some states, again, such as New York, there are federal and state implications. So you can only deduct administration expenses either on the estate tax return or on the fiduciary income tax return. That's the annual income tax return filed by the estate. So if you take, let's say, your attorney's fees, your executor's commissions, your appraisal fees, those kind of administration expenses, the old rule used to be just dump them all on the estate tax return because when I started practicing law 25 years ago, the federal estate tax highest rate was about 55%, so you were going to get the most bang for your buck putting everything on the estate tax return. Now you have to see between the federal estate tax rate being closer to the capital gains tax rate, being closer to the ordinary income tax rate, you kind of have to see both in terms of federal and state, does it pay to put all of the administration expenses on the estate tax return? In my experience running the numbers, very often, if you do have federal estate tax return required to be filed, it does pay to take it there. But I think you really have to run the numbers. The other thing to consider before you leave when you leave deductions off the federal estate tax return in order to take them on the fiduciary income tax return is that there's a time value of money concept. And let me elaborate on that. Estate tax is due in most cases 9 months after death. I'm ignoring 6166 elections. I'm ignoring the secretary giving you permission to pay late. Generally, the estate tax is due 9 months after death. And that's when the value of the deduction hits. So even if you haven't paid all of the administration expenses, you can still use the deduction on the estate tax return. However, the fiduciary income tax returns And we'll talk more about the fiduciary income tax returns in general in the second part of this podcast. But the fiduciary income tax returns are on an annual basis, and you can only deduct when you actually make the payment. So if you are deducting an administration expense 4 or 5 years after death, and you paid estate tax, the thing is that deduction, even if the rates were exactly the same, which maybe they were, maybe they're not, but even if the rates were exactly the same, you could have a situation where the deduction just from a time value of money had more use to be used on the estate tax return. This often people feel is an easy issue, but you also have to be careful because when you start using the expenses on one return versus the other, you may be shifting benefits between the beneficiaries. And the easiest example I can give is comparing the interest of a surviving spouse. As we know, for most gifts to a surviving spouse, there's an unlimited marital deduction for estate tax purposes. So for that surviving spouse, they're not going to generally be paying any estate tax. So an administration expense deduction doesn't really have any value to them. However, if they are a residuary beneficiary and the estate distributes income to them, so they receive income from the estate in a year, that income could be subject to income tax. So there's no marital deduction for an income distribution. It's just income in the hands of the surviving spouse. So the surviving spouse might want to use some of those administration expenses as income tax distributions because that's where he or she is going to see a benefit versus the estate tax. Again, you know, contrast that with, let's say, the children, who it may be in their interest to have it as an estate tax deduction. So they get more bang for their buck, so to speak, because you've run the numbers and you can say, okay, it will be overall to the family better financially to utilize these deductions on the estate tax return. And again, the surviving spouse, it may be, if it's the parent of the children, they may say that's perfectly fine. But let's say it's the surviving spouse is not the parent of the children. Then the executor may have an interesting dilemma as to where to put the administration expenses. So it's something that I think most people just throw on the estate tax return if there's one being filed, but I think some thought needs to go into it, both in terms of making sure it's the best financial result, but also making sure that you're achieving your fiduciary obligations if you have different sets of beneficiaries.
So as you mentioned before, the estate tax return is what obviously the estate files if necessary, but the fiduciary income tax return is what you file, is what the beneficiary files on an individual basis.
Not quite. So the fiduciary income tax return is filed by the estate on an annual basis where the estate reports its income and deductions and then issues Schedule K-1 to the beneficiaries. And then the beneficiaries have to take the information reported to him or her or them on that Schedule K-1 and report it on their own personal income tax return. So it is an estate prepared and filed return, the fiduciary income tax return. It's just these income taxation of estates is governed by Subchapter J of the Internal Revenue Code, and it's a little bit kind of a hybrid where if the estate makes the distributions of income, the beneficiaries bear the expense, and if the estate doesn't distribute, then the estate pays the income tax consequences for the year.
Okay, so let me just ask you one last question about commissions. How does executors and commissions work, and can the executor refuse to take a commission?
Those are great questions because I run into this in my practice, as you might imagine, quite a bit. First of all, just to lay the groundwork, a commission is generally what it's called for the compensation to the fiduciary of the estate, whether it's an executor, an administrator, a personal representative, a trustee. Commissions is usually the phrase that's used to describe the compensation that is paid to these fiduciaries for their service as fiduciary. So, depending on your state law, states tend to fall into one of two categories. New York, for example, we have a percentage. So it's really not a question of how much work the executor does or doesn't do. The executor gets paid a sliding scale based on the size of the estate that passes through the executor's hands. That's one approach. The other approach, which some jurisdictions take, is what's called reasonable compensation, where the executor essentially figures out what he or she thinks is a fair compensation. There may be guidelines, there may not be, and then either I assume all the beneficiaries agree or you go to court. I've never practiced in a, what we call a reasonable compensation jurisdiction, so I don't know quite the procedure for that. New York, in a way, is simpler, that as long as we all agree on the value and that the executor has done his or her job, we all know what his or her commission is going to be. However, in many cases, especially with family members may say, I don't want to take a commission. So let's take a step back. A commission is an administration expense. Commission could be deducted on the estate tax return or on the income tax return. However, it is income in the hands of the beneficiary. So if you take a very simple case where everything is left to the only child and the only child is the executor. So in theory, that only child who is the executor is entitled to a commission. However, assuming that there's no estate tax consequences, that the estate is below the thresholds, that commission, although a possible income tax deduction to the estate, would then be income in the hands of the executor. So very often when I'm dealing with family or even close friends, people are willing to serve as executor, but they don't want to receive a commission. And I tell these people it's important to make this decision early on, especially if you're going to have a taxable estate, but under any circumstances, it's important to make this decision early on because you have a problem with it being income. And there's a lot of case law out there outside the trust and estates area which talks about assignment of income and can you say no to income at some point. So I caution people we need to decide this usually as soon as possible once they're appointed, because the longer they do work, if they then decide they don't want to get paid for their past work, in theory the Internal Revenue Service could take a position against that. So Revenue Ruling 66-167 is instructive in this area, and it basically, I don't want to read you the revenue ruling, but suffice it to say, my feeling is that the waiver should be done within 6 months from the appointment, must certainly be done no later than filing the estate tax return. If you're filing an estate tax return, the waiver should be in writing and should also clearly state the extent of the waiver. So if it's waiving a certain amount, if it's waiving only under certain conditions, all of that should be in a writing in the waiver. And like I said, 6 months from appointment or no later than the preparation and filing of the estate tax return.
All right. So that's one of the many things that have to be done or can be done after the death of the person leaving the estate. And this is all great information because these are important questions. So that's the end of our podcast, part one of postmortem estate tax questions. And please join us for our next podcast, which will be postmortem income tax questions. Thank you, Mark. Thank you for joining us today on Talking Tax. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at Bloomberg Tax and subscribe to our show on iTunes and SoundCloud. Tune in next time for more analysis on the newest tax issues. From the nation's capital, I'm Andrea Ben-Yosef.